compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
Good morning, and welcome back to the Patrick Madrid Show, where you never know what kind of unpredictable conversations may arise here. Yours could be one of them. Give me a call at 888-914-9149. We'll get you on the air with your comment or question. Maybe you need a second opinion, whatever it might be. I'm here for you. And I'd like to say a special hello, a shout out, and lots of beautiful love going to about 300 people who were attending a talk that I gave last night at a parish in Noblesville, Indiana. And although Relevant Radio doesn't have a tower in this area, I could see that quite a few people there last night were downloading the Relevant Radio app. I talked a bit about the program. So for any of you who are listening in the Noblesville, Indiana, or the greater environs, since you've heard about Relevant Radio and this program, welcome. It's good to have you aboard. And I welcome your phone call as well. 888-914-9149. 888-914-9149. I had a little incident that took place yesterday. I thought I'd share this with you. You know how easy it is, or at least it is easy for me, to take for granted the fact that there are a lot of people out there who are in pain. Now, I don't mean, you know, necessarily a physical pain, although for many people that is a chronic problem, back pain, other aches and pains, arthritis, toothaches, you name it. The body can be very fragile, let's face it, and the body is an envelope of pain when you get hurt. And if you're in good health, and I, thanks be to God, I'm in good health. I mean, every so often, maybe something might happen, but thanks be to God, I've enjoyed good health my whole life, and I don't have pain. I don't live with pain. I have a buddy who lives with constant pain from some football injuries that he sustained when he was playing high school. He's my age now, so he's in his 60s, and he just lives with it. He just lives with the pain. So I take it for granted, honestly. And I'm not saying that because I'm proud of it. I just do. I mean, when you're not living with pain, you tend not to think about it. And then, of course, there's all the other emotional pain, the anguish and anxiety and fear and all kinds of other pains that can be just as debilitating as physical pain. I suppose some people are dealing with both. I can't imagine what that's like. But what happened to me yesterday, it was, you know, nothing spectacular, but it reminded me of pain. In a very particular way, and that was, I was getting out of the car. Nancy and I were going somewhere, getting out of the car and shutting the door to the car, and shutting my thumb in the door of the car. Now, I don't know if you've ever shut one of your fingers or a thumb in the car door. This is the kind where the car door completely closes. If you follow what I'm describing to you here. The car door completely closed, and my thumb from the knuckle, you know, the big knuckle in the middle, above that was in that tiny little space that wasn't made for thumbs, and my thumb was in there, and I can't even describe it. It was just an excruciating moment of pain. Thankfully, you know, the car didn't lock, and I was able to get it open very quickly. So my thumb was in there for maybe a matter of 3-4 seconds before I was able to extricate myself from this car door. And for maybe the next, I don't know, 5 minutes, my world narrowed. My whole universe narrowed to that thumb. That's the only thing in my universe that mattered to me that I could think about, that I could focus on. And the pain was excruciating. My wife says, "Did you break it?" I said, "I don't think so, because I could wiggle it back and forth. Didn't feel good, but I could wiggle it." So no, thankfully there was no bone broken. And amazingly, there was no blood. I'm not trying to gross you out. Please don't misunderstand me. I'm not trying to gross you out. So I'm not going to go into any other details. But there's nothing gory about it. Just my thumbnail looks like I'm wearing blue fingernail polish on it, because the bleeding underneath the fingernail, I mean, it's blue right now. It's probably going to turn other colors. Who knows what other colors it's going to turn before this whole ordeal is over. Doesn't hurt much now. I can still feel it. There's pain there, but not like it was for, say, the first hour or so. And as I'm, you know, in the car later on, I'm thinking about, I've got ice on my thumb, took a couple of Advil to knock it down a little bit. I was just thinking about, I'm experiencing pain. I'm not used to it. It's pretty severe, you know, on a scale from 1 to 10, they ask you when you go into the emergency room, on a scale of 1 to 10, how bad is the pain? I would honestly say for me it was a 10, at least for maybe the first 10 or 15 minutes of it. And so I was just reflecting on that and thinking to myself, all right, I've got pain. I didn't want anyone to talk to me. I didn't want to do anything. I just needed to be in my little cone of pain and just deal with it and wait till the pain subsided. Now, I cannot imagine what it would be like to live with, let's say, that kind of pain, or even just pain that's not quite that bad, but it's constant. It's always there. It's your friend, always at your side. You can't get away from it. It's like your shadow. No matter where you go, there it is. And I'll tell you, there are plenty of people out there who live with that kind of pain on a regular basis. So for me, I don't know if this is helpful to you. It was very helpful to me in a painful way, but it was very helpful to me because it was a reminder to me of, as you go through life, you're meeting people, maybe, you know, someone cuts you off in traffic. Maybe somebody treats you rudely. Maybe somebody is abrupt or peremptory with you. Maybe somebody doesn't make eye contact with you. Maybe somebody doesn't perform his or her duties as well as they might have, and it's irksome to you, as it is to me. We all go through these things. Just think to yourself that maybe that person is experiencing some type of chronic pain, and it's so debilitating that they're having a hard time getting through the day. So that's my little story. I thought I'd share it with you only because it happened to me yesterday, and I can still feel my thumb throbbing. May I say to you, my number is 888-914-9149. Let's go to Ruby in Pennsylvania. Good morning, Ruby.
Morning, Patrick. How are you?
I am, well, I'm great. My thumb's not so great, but it'll be better soon.
Oh, sorry to hear
that.
Well, I just want to share a quick story. I heard you talking about the Peter Rex article yesterday on tech and Christianity and tech. And
yeah.
I just want to share a story about my experience as I worked for Google for 7 years. And
I
just want to share
I'm all ears. What
yeah.
were you doing at Google,
I was a program manager, so I helped kind of organize projects for engineers. Yeah.
Okay.
And I really enjoyed it. And, of course, when I first started working there, the free coffees and free lunches were really the biggest draw. But it did get harder to work there over time. But I wanted to share a story about an incident where I spoke out and against kind of some, I thought, some moral evils going on in the company, and just the positive result it did have, just to really encourage any listeners.
Wait a minute. If I can interrupt, I think there's a delay
yeah.
because you can't hear me when I'm talking, and I think I'm unintentionally talking over you. Isn't Google's motto, don't be evil?
Yes, exactly. But as we see, you know, these companies are completely ideological. So anything that a lot of Christians would consider good, they consider evil. You know, we see these big corporations supporting LGBTQ month and doing big participations and big donations to these types of organizations. So it did become a growing conflict as I worked there. And so that kind of will lead me to what I wanted to say is Google, as an employee, you're allowed to donate and they can match your contributions to different organizations. And sometimes, I think in November, there's like Giving Week, and they actually allow organizations to come in so you can hear about them and then you can donate to them or even volunteer for them locally. And when I was there, we got an email that someone was sponsoring the local Planned Parenthood chapter who does commit abortions. And this email was sent out like, hey, they're going to be in talking about kind of some ways that you can get involved and help, you know, and they, of course, focus all on women's health. And I was so disturbed by this. And I thought, this is really heinous, and I feel like I need to say something. And so I sat on it for a bit. I was almost too cowardly to say anything. And finally, I just sent an email, and it went to the office, the whole office, which was about 1,000 people. And I just said, I'm shocked and horrified that this company is being brought in. I said, this is the number one abortion provider. And I said, I listed about 6 facts. I said, you know, they say they do these services. They don't. They make their money off of this. Their founder was rooted in eugenics. You know, I kind of basically said a few things. And I said, if anybody's out there that's also horrified like, please contact me. We can talk about it. But I said, please, like, you, like, open your eyes to this. And, you know, and ultimately I sent it and I was terrified. And the next morning I woke up to a barrage of mostly negative emails. One of the top directors in the office, who as a VP of his organization, like, really spoke out, basically called me a liar and said, disregard everything she said. And I didn't want to get into a battle of the words. So I just said, you know what, folks, nothing I said was untrue, but don't take his word, don't take mine, do your own research, it's out there. And among the other things, you know, it kind of spun out of control, but a ton of people reached out to me and just said, thank you for speaking out. I was very uncomfortable by this. And what ended up happening is we organized a lunch for all the people who were upset, just to kind of talk about, you know, most of the people were from Christian backgrounds. Some people were actually not even pro-life, but they said, I think it's really bad that they would organize this type of an event because it is a very polarizing topic. I mean, we had about 20 people show up. And from that effort, we said, well, why don't we organize and bring in our own speaker? And we tried to get Lila Rose to come in, and we went through the process and the channels to organize an official talk at Google, which is they bring in people there that, you know, can give talks as just extracurricular activities for Googlers, one of the many perks of working there. And ultimately, we got rejected. And the reason was is they were going through, I think Lila was really talking a lot about, like, censorship on Google and at Twitter, and they kind of used a lame excuse that, you know, we're having ongoing legal battles with, you know, talking about censorship, so we can't bring her in. But in the same deliberation hour of what speakers to bring in and not bring in, they allowed Cecil Richards, who is the former president of Planned Parenthood, to come in. You know, she, even though she was controversial, she had a book about being a leader. And so that's a quality we want to talk about. And so you could just see how they, you know, did things to support their own agendas, you know, come up with excuses to shut down the others. But I just want to say the last thing about it is,
so what happened?
You know, we
what
met
happened
for,
in the end? Did they run you off eventually, or did they peacefully coexist with you at that point?
They peacefully coexisted. The conversation died down, and they did bring in Planned Parenthood. And unfortunately, I wasn't able to attend that day because I actually wanted to attend. And, you know, they basically needed help doing, like, administrative stuff. They were very low-tech in their offices, you know, of course, where they're performing abortions. I wasn't able to be in the office, or I kind of would have gone and asked some pointed questions about other things their organization does that they don't really talk about. But I want to say the really great thing that came about it is we continued to meet every week, this group. And a bunch of Christians were in it and a bunch of non-Christians. And then eventually, like, we just met to talk about various pro-life issues. Then it kind of turned into conservative issues. And then ultimately, the Catholics kind of discovered each other. And then we started a Catholics lunch. And we, like, I left then after I started having children, and I'm a homemaker now. But, you know, as the last time I heard about it, you know, someone really took that group and ran off with it. And they walked to Mass during the week together, and they had book clubs, and they still met for lunch. And some of the non-Catholics and kind of the agnostic atheists who were in the original group of kind of conservatives who spoke against it were then kind of curious about it. So I just wanted to encourage people, you know, if you feel in any type of organization, not just big tech, to, if you feel the call to speak out or say something, you know, chances are you're not the only one who's feeling that. And if you are able to speak out, there's probably a lot of people who are going to thank you, whether or not they tell you or not. And that's a great opportunity to not only organize, but also to just be kind of a beacon for others there. And the last thing I want to say about it is, when I did do that, I received emails from people from different offices who had heard about it and supported it. So there are people everywhere. There are Christians going through what we're all going through at a number of workplaces, kind of falling to the woke ideologies these days. And just to speak out, and I'm happy that people like Peter Rex are doing something about it. And just a side comment, Peter Rex is actually my brother-in-law's brother. So I'm a second-level connection there. Yeah.
Now, as I understood, when I read his article on the air yesterday, I understood him to be like a venture capitalist. He does investments in companies and things. Is that right?
I believe so. I'm not exactly sure. I know he's transitioned to a number of things, but it looks like he's trying to boost, you know, the future of leaders to kind of get more and more, you know, Christians out there, and he's a Catholic himself. So I'm not exactly sure. I haven't followed it too closely. I have 3 children under 4, so I'm kind of flying by the seat of my pants these days. But I, one of my sisters mentioned that he was on the show, and then we were kind of talking about my experiences. So I'm not exactly sure, but maybe one of my sisters is listening. I have 5 older sisters who listen, and the one's married to the brother, so maybe she can chime in someday.
Yeah, sounds good. Well, do me a favor. Let him know that I was, not only did I like the article and found it very noteworthy, but I read it in its entirety on the program and offered some commentary. It might be interesting to him to listen to that.
Oh, absolutely. Will do. Thank you, Patrick.
You're most welcome. Well, fascinating phone call. I'm glad that you made it through the Google gauntlet relatively unscathed, and that is a good example for other people who may find themselves in similar situations where they're taking a beating for their beliefs, but they don't back down, as Tom Petty would say. So well done. I'm glad that
exactly.
you called in today.
Thanks,
you.
Patrick.
All right, quick timeout. We're coming back with more. You're welcome. We're coming right back with more of the Patrick Madrid Show. Your phone call can be part of that if you call us at 888-914-9149. I have another story I want to share with you, this having to do with white supremacy and a kind of code language that some people use. I'll share with you what some of those terms are when we come back. Today's programming sponsored by Solidarity HealthShare. Information on their health plans available at CatholicHealthShare.com. That's CatholicHealthShare.com.
Compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, real-life solutions you can believe in. The Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
All right, let's get this roadshow back on the road. If you'd like to be part of it, give me a call. The number is 888-914-9149. I'd love to talk to you. 888-914-9149. So I promised you a little bit of a glimpse into the world of white supremacy. It does exist. You know, not every white person is a white supremacist, and don't buy into the critical race theory nonsense that's being propounded by the left nowadays. But it is true. There is a white supremacist sector of people in this country, elsewhere as well, for that matter. But let's talk about what's in these United States. Yeah, this is an article in cron.com. And I found it fascinating because, you know, I don't really give much thought, honestly. I don't pay much attention to the crazies out there with the KKK outfits and the, you know, the militia people. And not necessarily that the militia people necessarily overlap with that, but often they do. So I never really give it much thought. I know they're there, but I don't really give it much thought. So when I read this article, I thought, okay, there's some interesting stuff here. And I wanted to share it with you. So it's about during the Charlottesville trial. Charlottesville, of course, when the two demonstration groups clashed and a white supremacist drove a vehicle into the crowd and killed one woman. And you remember all the mayhem that surrounded that. It was a terrible situation. So this is referring to the trial and how the jurors in the trial, they had to learn how to decode certain secret slang that's used by white supremacists. So here goes. The jury in this federal courtroom listened as a longtime researcher of far-right movements parsed the style guide of the infamous neo-Nazi website called The Daily Stormer. The tone of the site should be light. This is the person commenting on this in the courtroom. The tone of the site should be light. Most people are not comfortable with material that comes across as vitriolic or raging or non-ironic hatred. The unindoctrinated should not be able to tell if we're joking or not, according to a guide in the section called LULZ, L-U-L-Z, which stands for laughing out loud. Continuing with a derogatory term for Jews, it read, "This is obviously a ploy, and I actually do want to gas," and then it uses the pejorative word for Jews, but that's neither here nor there. The evidence, the article says, introduced in an ongoing civil trial against organizers of the deadly 2017 Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville, appeared to highlight a sinister strategy expert witness Pete Simi was trying to teach the jurors, the ways in which the white supremacists employ humor to shield their calls for violence in an effort to render them legally ambiguous. As jurors considered the plaintiff's accusations that the rally organizers conspired to foment racial violence, They have been presented with a trove of evidence that includes messages laced with slurs, memes of using cars to run over protesters, calls for cracking skulls. Over the past several weeks, plaintiffs' attorneys have tried to make their case by carefully breaking down the jokes and catchphrases that are favored by far-right extremists. And by the way, I'll pause here. There are plenty of far-left extremists out there as well, Antifa and other fascist groups that are out there. So in this case, it's referring specifically to those on the right. So they're looking at these jokes and catchphrases that are favored by the far-right extremists in an effort to teach jurors how to decode white supremacists' secret vocabulary of hate. Whether the jury takes this evidence literally or views it as an exaggeration is the crux of many arguments in this trial. The plaintiff's attorneys have called in experts to help jury understand, help the jury understand what is sinister about the numbers 1488. You may see 1488 and say, what happened in 1488? Well, it refers to 14 words, a popular white supremacist slogan in Heil Hitler, because H is the eighth letter of the alphabet. So 88 would stand for HH, which stands for Heil Hitler. They have translated the phrase Rahowa, so R-A-H-O-W-A, which may sound like gibberish to outsiders, but among hate groups, it stands for racial holy war. And they explained how a question that seems innocuous, did you see Kyle? K-Y-L-E, did you see Kyle? Is actually a play on words for the Nazi salute Sig Heil. Did you see did you see Kyle? So you can see how see Kyle sounds like Sieg Heil in Germany, in German, excuse me. The white supremacist movements use lots of insider language and codes and specific references that could require a kind of insider's knowledge, Simi said in the courtroom. They can talk about violence, they can advocate for violence, and then say, well, it was just a joke. Deborah Lipstadt, a renowned Holocaust scholar, testified about the ways anti-Semitism is a bedrock of white supremacist ideology and one that was featured during the Unite the Right rally that weekend, notably at the Friday Night Torch March, where a mob chanted, Jews will not replace us. She said the ideology behind these chants comes from the so-called Great Replacement Theory, the conspiratorial idea of an engineered demographic replacement of white Christians that is frequently repeated on right-wing or by right-wing pundits. She says it is a call to battle. Heidi Beirich, a co-founder of the Global Project Against Hate and Extremism and former director of intelligence at the Southern Poverty Law Center, which, by the way, is an extremist organization unto itself, may I say to you, so even though this article is quoting some crazy left-wing organizations, just bear with it because it's going to provide you with some of the coded language that you should be aware of in any case. So if you see it, you'll know what it's all about and you can avoid it. Let's see. It shows you how much the online world has pervaded the offline world, Beirich says. This fact is I wish more Americans knew what the jurors are hearing right now. Attorneys for the plaintiffs, nine people who alleged physical harm and emotional distress that weekend, and defendants began closing their arguments this past Thursday. The lawsuit backed the Integrity First for America, a civil rights nonprofit organization. It's underpinned by more than a 150-year-old statute designed to protect newly emancipated black people from the Ku Klux Klan. Throughout this trial, defendants have argued that they were exercising their First Amendment rights in Charlottesville. Inside the courtroom, they have used the N-word. They've used repeated slurs for Jewish people and openly praised Adolf Hitler. What a stupid thing to do. I mean, stupid is as stupid does, if you ask me. If you're on trial for being, you know, for inciting racial hatred, and you're in the courtroom trying to defend yourself, how idiotic to just do the very thing that you're claiming that you're innocent of doing. And they've dismissed calls for violence as hyperbolic jokes. Jason Kessler, a defendant and lead organizer of the Unite the Right rally, testified that many of the messages presented in court were simply blank posting, slang, or posting something provocative just to get a rise out of somebody. Defendants blamed the mayhem of that weekend on counter-protesters that they labeled Antifa. Well, Antifa labels itself Antifa. Even though they claim to be anti-fascist, they are fascist. Experts and attorneys for the plaintiffs say this deflection is part of a playbook to avoid accountability. Attorney Karen Dunn said in court, plausible deniability, just like mace and shields and flagpoles, was a tool of this conspiracy. Plausible deniability is when you set up a situation in such a way that you can claim later that you had nothing to do with it. In the courtroom, plaintiffs' attorneys played a podcast recording with the voice of defendant Christopher Cantwell, who became widely known as the crying Nazi following an emotional video posted when a warrant was issued for his arrest. It was an episode from an August 7th, 2017 podcast, days before he joined hundreds of white supremacists in Charlottesville for a rally that turned deadly when a neo-Nazi sped his car into a crowd of counter-protesters, killing that woman I mentioned to you earlier, a 32-year-old Heather Heyer. James A. Fields Jr., who was sentenced to life in prison for the car ramming, is also a defendant in this civil suit. Cantwell said, I'm not even a Hitlerite, but I'm like, okay, let's, and I'm going to leave out the bad words here, let's gas, he's referring to Jews here, let's gas them and have a race war, and then he laughed. Attorney Roberta Kaplan asked Simi, can you explain, Professor, what's going on in that clip? Simi pointed to the eerie juxtaposition of Cantwell's laughter after his call for mass murder. I can't tell you how many times over the last 25 years, she said, that I've seen similar instances where violent references, violent rhetoric is cloaked with some reference to humor. Cantwell has pleaded guilty in a separate case to two counts of assault and battery stemming from his use of pepper spray during the Unite the Right rally weekend. He's also serving a 41-month federal prison sentence after being convicted of extortion and threat charges. So in the courtroom, they're seeing these videos and hearing podcasts, and they're decoding this doublespeak. They're decoding these terms, these words that are used regularly. So I bring this to your attention, first of all, because white supremacy, wherever it exists, should be denounced. It should be eliminated. It's wrong. It's immoral. It has no place in our society. And I don't know how long it will take before it can be eradicated, but please God, someday it will. But in the meantime, it's worthy of our note, it's worthy of our attention to be aware of these kinds of things, so that if, you know, maybe some of your kids' friends start saying things like that. I mean, just imagine if you heard your kid's high school friend saying, have you seen Kyle? That, if I were a parent of a teenage kid, and I, now that I know this, if I heard that, I would be all over that. All over that. And I would want to find out, you know, if my son was in any way cavorting with people like that, and then take steps to put a stop to that. So the article will be up on the show Twitter feed. It's at P Madrid Show. You can also find it on the show page, which is relevantradio.com/Patrick. It's important to know about these things. They are disgusting and they're revolting, but they're real, and we have to be aware of them. And, take steps as necessary. 888-914-9149. Let's go to Ashley, who's listening right now. Where is Ashley? In Arlington, Texas. Good morning, Ashley.
Good morning, Patrick. My condolences to your thumb.
Thank you.
I have a question.
My thumb appreciates
Oh, good. My sister-in-law is getting married next year, and we've heard through my other sister-in-law that she would like to have my daughter as her flower girl. It's a secular wedding, and the only thing we really know through my other sister-in-law is that the officiant is supposed to be a strong, independent woman. So given all of that, we can only assume what the wedding will be like, and I mean, our guts say not to let her do that, but can you confirm whether or not that would be...
A couple questions that will help me do that. So, yeah, a couple questions. One would be, is the two people who are getting married, I presume it's a man and a woman, first of all, is either one of them Catholic? If you said that, I must have missed it, but is either one of them Catholic?
Raised Catholic, but definitely not practicing.
Okay, so raised Catholic, like received the sacraments Catholic, got confirmed Catholic, and then fell away in college or something?
Yes, exactly.
Okay, yeah. So in my rule book, I would say no. Because here's the thing. Let me put it this way. If it were two atheists getting married, yes, she could go. If it were two, you know, let's say it was two Protestants getting married, yes, she could go and be a flower girl. If it was some combination of people getting married, either non-baptized, or in the case of two baptized Protestants, it would be fine. Where it becomes not fine is where a Catholic is involved. And even though you say she was raised Catholic and she received the sacraments, even though she or he fell away from the church, that person is still Catholic, and still, whether he realizes it or not. Is it a he or a she, first of all? I don't want to keep saying the wrong pronoun. In this case, the pronouns are important. Okay, she. Okay, so when it comes to a Catholic, the problem is that you never really stop being a Catholic. So even though she's walked away from the church, she's still Catholic, and she still has the obligations that are incumbent upon all Catholics, one of which is to get married according to the church's canonical form. And in the case of the Catholic, the canonical form is to be married in a church in the presence or having the marriage blessed by a priest. It could also be a deacon, could also be a bishop. But that's the church's requirement. Now, it can be dispensed by the bishop if a dispensation is sought. I don't think very often people even realize that they should seek a dispensation. But assuming that she didn't seek a dispensation, that would be an invalid marriage for her, and for her husband too. So it's not a problem with non-Catholic folk, and in particular, let's say non-Christian folk, and their weddings are valid. But in the case of a Catholic, because this is also a sacrament, the sacrament of holy matrimony, it is invalid if they don't get married according to the proper canonical form, in which case it would be essentially going to a wedding that you knew is not valid and celebrating something that you knew wasn't valid. And I realize that this creates lots of, you know, heartache and misunderstanding and hard feelings, and sometimes it can really tear a family apart. I'm sure people listening right now can attest to that in some cases. But that's ultimately what the church is saying on this issue. So as I look at it, I would not let my daughter go and be a flower girl, because that would be, in essence, telling a lie. Like, hey, we're celebrating something that really shouldn't be celebrated. You see what I mean?
So to clarify, we can't even go?
I wouldn't
to
go.
To the wedding, all of us? Okay.
Well,
yeah, that's going to cause,
I know it's hard,
a lot of problems, especially with our other Catholic family members who will go. But
yeah.
Okay.
I understand it.
That's going to be hard.
Before you go, let me give you a scenario that I think will help put this more into perspective. Okay. St. John the Baptist, he was a thorn in the side of King Herod. You know the story, right? And
yes.
The big problem was that King Herod had married his brother's wife. So he's now, you know, married, quote unquote, to this woman who is not his wife. His brother's ex-wife. He's living with her as if she were his wife. St. John the Baptist says, stop it. This is wrong. You shouldn't do this. So he denounces this evil arrangement. And of course, eventually one thing leads to another, and St. John the Baptist is martyred by having his head cut off over this thing. Could you imagine if King Herod came down to St. John the Baptist's prison cell and say, check it out, I don't want to have this problem with you. And just, you know, for the sake of togetherness and all that, would you just come to the wedding reception? Could you just come to this reception? Come to this wedding with my brother's wife and just be there. You don't have to say anything. You don't have to do anything, and have some nice cake and champagne afterward. Could you just do that? I mean, could you picture St. John the Baptist saying, okay, I'll go. I'll celebrate with you. Can you imagine him doing that?
No, yeah. No, he would not do that, of course.
He would not do that. So much so that he was willing to offer his own life rather than compromise and do something that was wrong. Now, I don't mean to make this overly dramatic, because none of you are going to be beheaded by the time this is all over. But for me personally,
only
I see kind of a one-to-one. Yeah, I mean it metaphorically. maybe, you know, in theory or figuratively, it might feel like people are coming after you. But I put it in those terms for this reason. In other words, there is a one-to-one comparison here. It is a wedding. It is an invalid wedding. And if St. John the Baptist would not go to that invalid wedding and celebrate, I have to say in my heart of hearts, then why would I say, well, I will go and celebrate something that I know is also invalid? And so for me, I would just say, I'm sorry, I love you, I support you, but I can't support this. And if I go and celebrate, it's a cause of scandal, because I'm now publicly saying yes to something that I know is wrong. And I can't do that.
Okay.
That's my take on it.
All right. Well, pray for me, Patrick. Thank you.
I will. You're most welcome. I know it's going to be difficult, but God will give you the strength. And for that matter, and thanks for the call, Ashley. For that matter, I want to point out that I'm well aware that there are many priests who would say, oh, just go for the sake of family togetherness. That's more important. You want to keep your family together. That's more important. I respectfully disagree. I love my family from here to kingdom come. And I would do anything for my family, as you would for your family, all of you. So I don't mean to discount or minimize the importance of family togetherness in going the extra mile and doing anything that you can do to help your family. I totally believe in all of that, 100%. But at the same time, there's a limit to how far one can go if you realize that if you go over a particular line, you're now suddenly doing something that's wrong. So I will love and support my family members, but if they're down on their luck and they don't have any food, I'm not going to rob a store or a bank to get money to feed them because they're poor, because doing that would be wrong. I'd have to find other ways of trying to support them. So that may not be, you know, an exact enough parallel, but for me, that's the way to look at it. And, you know, let's face it, I have a large family. I've got a lot of kids, a lot of grandkids, and over time, as people grow up and mature and make their decisions, there may well come a day. I hope it doesn't happen, but it's possible that there might come a day when I personally will be faced with this very question. What am I going to do? So I'm just kind of going on record saying, even though I haven't been tested in this way before, it could happen. And this is the painful decision that I feel that I would have to make in that situation. So I'm right there with everybody else in looking at this. I have to take a break. We'll come back with more of the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio. 888-914-9149. 888-914-9149. We have a line or two open. You can call now. When I return, I'm going to share with you the top names that parents are giving their boys in the UK. You might be surprised. I was surprised at the number one name in the UK. I'll tell you what that is when we come back.
You have a special place in God's plan for the world. Learning about Christ's role in history can change your life and strengthen your faith. Right now, get free access to Christendom College's online history class at principlesclasses.com/Madrid.
Welcome back to the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio. Have a question? Give Patrick a call. 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149. Patrick Madrid on Relevant Radio.
Okay, we are back. Now, if you're in the UK, this may not come as a surprise to you. But if you're in the US like I am and most of the rest of the listeners are, every year they do a survey of the top names. They do it in the US too, but this was interesting. So for the newborn baby boys born in the UK in 2021, the year's not quite over yet, but the number one name that's the most often given is, can you guess? Mohammed. According to Baby Center, Mohammed retains the crown for the fifth year running, followed by Noah and Oliver. The latest government statistics place Oliver in first place in 2020, with Mohammed only fifth. This contradiction has an explanation, though. With Mohammed, and these are three variant spellings. So one that ends in A-D, one that ends in E-D, and one that has another way of being spelled that ends in A-D, being versions of the same name. So if you consider it all the same name, which it is, of course, it is by far the most popular name being given to male boys in England. Now, there's something more to this story. By the way, the baby girl names, if you're wondering, the top baby girl names for 2021, Olivia, second place Sophia, third place Lily. Sources of inspiration were as diverse as superheroes, sporting heroes, plus a greater move toward gender neutrality and unisex names. Parents also looked for hope of a beginning and dreams of travel in the year and started with lockdown. So names like Nova, Neo, Aurora, and Eden were popular. Willow, Blake, and Noah were also popular. Some parents' choices were also inspired by popular TV hits such as Bridgerton. And this is a name. Bridgerton. Getting names from that. Also, they were naming people after Squid Game, which is that new crazy, hyper-violent South Korean Hunger Games type of game. Anyway, so those are things. There is a link in this article that will give you all 100 of them if you're interested, and you can see maybe where your name falls in that list. But just stop and think about that for a minute, that Muhammad is now the most popular boy's name in England. Now, I suspect that there is more than one reason for this. One reason, of course, would be the increase in the number of Muslim immigrants who are coming to the UK. And naturally, if the more of them there are, and as they're having children, the more likely it is that they're going to name their son Muhammad. That's a common thing. But I think there's another reason for it, and that is that largely in the West, and this is certainly true in the UK, people are just not having children. So those who have family lineage in England, let's say, for hundreds of years, they're just not having children. And the replacement level, the fertility rate in the West is abysmal. And in order to keep a population stable, all other things being equal in terms of war, natural disasters, and other issues like that, all of those other things being equal, in any given population, the replacement level, the fertility rate, needs to be at about 2.1, maybe 2.2, children per childbearing age woman. And if that is the trend in a given population, then the population will flatline, basically. It's not going to go up, it's not going to go down. As soon as that figure, that statistic of 2.1 children per childbearing age woman begins to fall, the population will begin to fall. It's just simple math. If you're not having enough children, you can't replace the people who are dying every year. Old age, accidents, disease, etc. A lot of people die every year, so you need a lot of new people, or at least the same amount of new people coming into the population just to keep it stable. So this is one reason why you see so many boys in England and the rest of the UK being named Muhammad, and that's because the people there who tend to have more children and who are fulfilling God's mandate to be fruitful and multiply, they're not the British. They're people who are coming from elsewhere. And I did not see that mentioned in the article. But you can read it for yourself and all the statistics surrounding it by going to the show page, relevantradio.com/Patrick. Let's go to Alex in Minneapolis. Good morning, Alex.
Good morning. I have a question about mortification of the flesh. I read that a lot of saints, including Padre Pio and others, used it. Yet I don't see it encouraged, nor do I see it talked about in the modern church. Could you explain the history of that?
Well, I mean, it goes all the way back to the Old Testament. You see the prophets and other significant figures at times who would engage in asceticism, mortification of the flesh, and that typically would involve fasting or vigils where you don't allow yourself to sleep for long periods of time, ways of doing without that cause suffering to the body. We see our Lord doing that when, just before he began his public ministry, he went into the desert for 40 days and he didn't eat any food for 40 days. I cannot imagine what that would have been like, but he did it. And we see the other apostles, we see the apostles and others who performed acts of mortification in the New Testament. So this going to say that it is part of the Christian tradition to, as St. Paul says, he says, I buffet my body and make it my slave, lest I who have preached to others may myself be disqualified. So what he means by that, it may have been that he was doing some form of like corporal punishment, like whipping himself on the back. That's possible. Many of the great saints did that as a way to mortify the flesh. It causes pain. It may also have been a figure of speech for him saying that I buffet my body, meaning that I don't give in to the demands of my body, the demands for sleep, the demand for food, the demand for drink, the demand for sex, the demand for entertainment. It could have been a figurative way of saying that I buffet my body, meaning that I don't give it the things that it wants. I master it. I subdue those unruly passions that we all have. We all have these unruly passions. So the mortification of the flesh essentially means to put to death those unruly passions by starving them or depriving them of what they want. Now, obviously, you have to stay alive, so you have to eat. You have to consume at least water to stay alive. You have to sleep to stay alive. So you can't do this endlessly, but the great saints tell us that the more that you have this command, this mastery over your bodily appetites, the more likely it is that you're going to be able to grow in holiness. And if you're doing it for that purpose, you know, you don't want to be sadistic about it, or in this case, I guess, masochistic, because it's happening to you. If you're doing it for a holy reason and you're doing it as a way to purify yourself and free yourself as much as can be done from your bodily appetites so that you can concentrate on God, that's a good thing. It's not not everybody is capable of it. In fact, I would say most people tend to not be capable of it. And an example of this can be given in the writings of St. Francis de Sales. He wrote a massive book called An Introduction to the Devout Life. I mean, massive in terms of its influence. And in it, he gives some really good advice to the spiritual directee that he's writing to in this book. And he says, don't undertake these mortifications of the flesh without checking with your spiritual advisor, checking with your spiritual director, if you have one. Long fasts, long vigils, you know, sleeping on the floor, things like that, that can be harmful to your health. And he advises that little mortifications for most people tend to be the better kind rather than something that's more extreme. So there's a few things about mortification of the flesh. Does that help, Greg? Hello, Greg?
Oh, hi. I didn't know.
I apologize. I made a mistake. That was my mistake. Alex, I meant to go to you. Go ahead, Alex. I don't know if I think we lost Alex. My mistake. Yeah, Greg, I thought I was going to Alex and I was saying your name. My mistake. So you're on the air now, Greg.
Okay. What I'm curious about is communal baptism. Now, what I'm referring to is two mentions in the Bible from the Acts of the Apostles. Peter said, do penance and be baptized, every one of you, and you shall receive the gift of the Holy Ghost. And then he went further to say, or was further stated in the Acts, that they therefore received his word, were baptized, and there were added in that day about 3,000 souls. Now, I'm curious that, I mean, I'm sure Peter and the apostles didn't go and sprinkle water on 3,000 foreheads. Was it a communal baptism? Was it,
no.
And is such a thing recognized in the church today? I'll listen for my
no.
Your reply.
Okay, yeah. So the answers are no and no. It was not a communal baptism because, first of all, in Jerusalem there is no body of water, nothing remotely approaching the size of a body of water that would be needed, even just to baptize, like say, 100 people at a time. You would still have to do, you know, 30 of those baptisms. That went with 30 or 300, I forget which. But in any case, no. So these baptisms would have been almost certainly baptisms by infusion. Sprinkling is not recognized as a valid form of baptism in the Catholic Church. Pouring of water is. So it could have been a combination of, in some of these pools, like the Pool of Bethsaida and some of the other pools where, you know, it's kind of like a very small swimming pool. There might have been space for people to go into that water and be baptized. But for 3,000 plus people to be baptized, my view is it almost certainly had to include being baptism by having water poured over their heads. So it doesn't give us that specific detail, but I think that's, given the circumstances, that's likely what happened. But they were all baptized that day. And could you imagine your parish growing by 3,000 members in one day because of 3,000 baptisms? Well, anyway, I hope that's helpful to you. Thank you. How about now we go to... No, we don't have to. Let's go to a break. Let's do that. 888-914-9149. That break snuck up on me right there, but we have two more hours to go, and I'd love to be in contact with you. So give me a call, 888-914-9149. Plenty ahead after this. I'm going to give you an update on what's going on COVID-wise in Australia, and plenty more right after this quick timeout.